Hello, my name is Bruce Eder, and I'd like to welcome you to the Criterion Collection edition of Dr. No. For this secondary audio track, we've assembled discussions with Terence Young, the director of Dr. No from Russia with Love and Thunderball, Peter Hunt, the editor of the first five James Bond films and the director of On Her Majesty's Secret Service, Ken Adam, the production designer on all but one of the Sean Connery Bond movies, and Richard Maybaum, the author or co-author of all but three of the United Artists James Bond pictures. Let's start with Peter Hunt and his recollections about this very famous signature graphic opening and how it came about.
This was a very clever piece of work by Morris Binder. This opening shot here was through the barrel of the gun and the blood coming down. Terrific. Yeah, and of course, I know all these dots have become a little old-fashioned now, but you must remember that, you know, way back in 1960, this was all new stuff. This was all very modern. He's so clever at doing all that, as indeed he did all the titles, I think, except from Russia with Love.
Terence Young.
The music was originally written by somebody else, not by John Barry, but I wasn't happy with the theme that we had. They were trying to use Underneath the Mango Tree as a theme for James Bond, and I said, well, that's a really stupid idea, because eventually you're going to be making pictures without mango trees, and you're going to look a bit stupid, you know. Somebody at United Artists Music told them about John Barry, who had a small band, and he came up with that thing, which I think was wonderful. I think it was very effective and helped the film enormously.
Terence Young has his own special appreciation of one particular aspect of Maurice Binder's work.
He is a genius for getting, no matter what the picture is, a lot of naked girls into the credit titles. And he usually shoots these scenes of the girls in a swimming pool himself without the help of any other director or cameraman. You know, these girls have got clothes on. It's surprising. That was perhaps later he got sexy.
Peter Hunt.
It was one of the early films of special titles. We've grown so used to it, it's very hard to realize that in those days they didn't make special titles. They put the names up over part of the film or something that had been shot. It was a nice segue into there. They're actually walking on a treadboard on the studio with a white backing, just a white backing. And Morris has put in a couple of red blobs and the other things to make it, give it some reality. But in fact, that is just a white backing, white and blue backing, and the feet. And it's lit, of course, in that shadow. Now we're into the real shoot of the film.
Terence Young.
That was shot in Kingston, Jamaica, and believe me, you wouldn't be doing that in broad daylight today without about 600 policemen there around you. It's one of the most dangerous places in the world. When you look at the picture, eventually, I still can't believe that we made it for $1 million, because we had all these different locations. We were in Kingston, we were in Ocho Rios, we were in Montego Bay. And the picture, chiefly due to Mr. Ken Adam, had a very, very luxurious look. The actor on the right, Anthony Dawson, is one of the few people who played in more than one of the Bond pictures. One time there was a rule that nobody could play in more than one, but we broke that once or twice. And nearly all these actors were just amateurs from their other jobs in Jamaica.
We're coming up on a sequence that became far more exciting through Peter Hunt's editing.
People, when they used to see this sequence, other people in the studio used to go, oh, can you do that? And I would say, sure, it tells you the story, doesn't it? You know, it makes it exciting. What do you want to do? Why do you want to hang on to it further? And then when we came to mix the tracks, the mixer, who's dead now, God rest his soul, lovely old Mac at Pinewood, was very cooperative with me, because I used to say, make that louder, make that door bang really hard, don't give it a natural sound, give it an unnatural sound, this is an unnatural piece of work, you know. And he did, you know, and he would do things. He got into the spirit that I tried to inject into him, rather than being an old fuddy-duddy with sausage hands, you know, as they so many are.
To save money, we shot in real houses and things like that. Now, yes, this is the lady who, she got the job in this particular sequence because she owned the house and she allowed us to use it. It wasn't quite an ultimatum, but I know it helped us get the house.
I didn't have any to cut to. That's what you wanted to see, that jump cut. That is in order just to make the crack of the glass of the window and the crack of the bullet come closer together. And I was able to overlap the sound so that you weren't really conscious of the jump cut. I suppose I took out about 3 feet of film there. Normally, if I want to do that, then I'd cut to the body or her clutching herself, then back to him with another man shooting. But I really didn't have anything because I didn't have the material, you see.
The action now shifts to London in one of those quick edits by Peter Hunt that characterized the entire picture. The communications room is the first and most conservative of Ken Adams' sets, but one where high technology for 1962 does play a part. He explains.
It was again, you know, I felt that the office of the MI5 chief, should be very conservative in a traditional English office setting with period furniture, and he was reputed to be an ex-naval officer, so it showed some of, you know, I had naval prints and other things. Whereas his communications room, again, I wanted to be high-tech for that period, with a lot of computers and tape recorders and maps and so on. And it was really, I think, the first time that I tried to do something which was contemporary and maybe slightly ahead of its time. Initially, the screenplays were very true to Ian Fleming's books. The visual style of the films developed, but it obviously started with Dr. No, which was slightly larger than life, tongue in the cheek, and at the same time an expression of our electronic age and computers and all that.
This is really a steal on the introduction of Paul Muni and Juarez, you know, the man talking and everything off for a long time. But it was one hell of a good introduction, I'll tell you.
The house will cover the difference.
Yeah, madame.
She played in two of the Bond pictures. She was in From Russia with Love. Eunice Gayson, her name was.
Carte.
Neuf à la banque.
I need Carte. Another 1,000.
In the original books, he had a gunmetal cigarette case and a gunmetal lighter. But nobody bothered about a nonsense like that from then onwards.
Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
That's the first view of Mr. James Bond. And even that I messed up as a director. I had him saying, Bond, James Bond. But the way it worked, it wasn't good. I tried something else, and he goes, my name is Bond. Buck, James Bond. And it just made the difference with the lighter. But he was a fine-looking guy, and he had a splendid physique, he really did. We had made a picture some years before, not a very good picture, for MGM, called Action of the Tiger, with Van Johnson and a marvelous French actress called Martine Carol. She really was something. And when the picture was over, she said to me, she said, this is the boy who is going to be a big, big star. And I have to be honest, I didn't see it at that moment. He was playing a pretty rough, uncouth deckhand on a boat. And it didn't really occur to me that he was ever going to be a big actor at that time, I have to be honest. But when we did Bond, and after we'd been working together for about a week, I just knew that it was going to click. Because he was really interested, he was really trying. Sean did everything you asked him and more. I think he really said, this is my chance. I made a lot of unsuccessful pictures and this is the chance for me. He is probably the least spoiled of actors of any of them I've ever met. He's still the most natural. My two favorites are Audrey Hepburn as a woman and Sean as a man. He leads his own private life. He's never changed. That's my gag, yes. I was doing it with his hat before he came in, and I did it 3 times in a row. And Sean said, let me try. I said, no, wait till the cameras turn. And so help me God, we had to do about 10 takes before he got it right. After which, he was able to do it all the time. She was my choice, Moneypenny. She'd made her first film with me when I made my first film as a director, a film called Corridor Mirrors in France. And she played a tiny part in that. And she came to see me, and I remembered it, and that was it. She got the jump. She's very good.
Peter Hunt.
It was a nicely set up relationship when you think of this as the first time, and that she went on through all the other films with the same. You knew, okay, the hat came in on the stand. Oh, we're going to get back to Moneypenny. And in a way, I think this perhaps is one of the popular things about the films. Old Warner days when they had their own repertory company, audiences knew what Sidney Greenstreet was going to be like, what Peter Lorre was going to be like, and they, when they saw these characters, they identified with them right away. And this film set up all these characters.
Jamaica went off the air tonight, just like that, right in the middle of the opening procedure.
And Bernard Lee was a famous actor, a famous English actor, who in fact was in a lot of Carol Reed films. You'll see him any night on your television set in The Third Man, playing a soldier. He was a handsome young man, and he went on to become a fine actor and was ideal for the head of MI5.
This is Bernard Lee, who was a darling man, a lovely man, who had worked for me before in some other picture. Pretty bad picture, I seem to remember. I think Sean's dinner jacket is one of the best looking bits of tailoring I've seen for a long time. And Bernie Lee got the job because everybody else that we wanted was away, and he only was asked the day before to show up, and it was just like he got the job one day before the film started.
Bernard Lee was already a very busy 28-year veteran of films when he got the call to portray M in Dr. No. The son of a music hall performer named Edmund Lee, he'd made his stage debut with his father at the age of 6. His first picture, The Double Event, dated from 1934, and he made his first starring appearance on Broadway in 1938, opposite Constance Cummings in If I Were You. Apart from the Bond movies, he's probably best known to moviegoers for his portrayal of the sympathetic military police sergeant in The Third Man. And he was still getting leading roles in small British pictures during the 1960s, such as Saturday Night Out. He was working on London's West End in the early 1970s, prior to his death from cancer in 1981.
Before. You tell him. For the last time. Nice and light. In a lady's handbag.
This chap was very silly. He could have had a job for the rest of his life playing the armourer. He had the choice of going off and doing Russia with Love, or doing some other little part in another picture. He chose the other picture, which was never finished. And he always regretted it. I knew him quite well. He just died this year. He's a very nice man called Peter Burton.
And another thing. Since I've been head of MI7, there's been a 40% drop in double O operative casualties, and I wanted to stay that way. You'll carry the water.
The sequence in which Bond gives up his famed 25 caliber Beretta is taken directly out of the book Dr. No, but with a couple of twists. The book had actually been written after From Russia with Love, a novel that ends with Bond, the victim of a seemingly successful lethal attack by Rosa Klebb, when his Beretta jams. M refers to it and the fact that Bond spent 6 months in hospital as a result. Since From Russia with Love hadn't been done as a film yet, however, he's obviously talking about another incident. The change of weapon in the movie represents an improvement over the same sequence in the book. One of Ian Fleming's curious lapses in the novels, where it came to arms and armaments, was his choice of the 38-caliber Smith & Wesson Centennial Airweight as the larger of 007's two new weapons. The Smith & Wesson wasn't really the kind of heavy weapon that Fleming wrote of it as being, and it never did reappear in the books after Dr. No. Ken Adam.
Because of the limited budget, the finishes in M's office were you know, in the old film studio technique. Eventually, on the following films, such as Goldfinger, and when we repeated this office every time, I used real teak ply and real leather doors rather than faking it. I felt that he was a sportsman and at the same time very British, and a conventional apartment with a certain amount of antique furniture, but also showing a set of his golf clubs to give him a personality that this was a well-educated person.
The tailor made a fortune after this picture. Everybody kept writing in. They didn't write about the picture. They just said, who's James Bond's tailor? In fact, David Picker, who was the president of United Artists and very much responsible for the Bond films getting made, because he was a terrific fan, I think he went out and bought about 30 suits the next week, and then everybody stampeded. I went to all his fittings for his clothes, and I took him to my shirt maker in Paris and also in London. And I must say, I think Sean was much better dressed in my three pictures than the others. She was meant to be nude, but in those days we weren't allowed such luxuries as you would have had today. Today she'd have been stark naked.
Eunice Gayson had a successful British screen career going back to the early 1950s. Her movie credits included the comedy Miss Robin Hood, starring Margaret Rutherford, The Last Man to Hang with Tom Conway, and Carry On Admiral with David Tomlinson. Her character Sylvia was supposed to be a continuing one in the James Bond series, but was dropped when Terence Young pulled out of directing Goldfinger.
This was all done in the actual airport in Jamaica. They had terrible weather in Jamaica, and we had a number of days when it just wasn't possible to shoot the things that we wanted to shoot that were scheduled. Jack Lord was a very fine supporting actor in those days. Nice man, and ideal for the character he played. I'm sorry he didn't go on to play the character in the other films, but by the time we were making the other films, he was busy doing his own stuff and had become too big for us.
This was a Miss Jamaica. Practically everybody was a Miss Jamaica in this picture.
The girl photographer's name, by the way, was Margaret Loires, and all of these sequences were photographed on the first day shooting in Jamaica. Dr. No was actually one of the more recent books, but its direct inspiration predated the books considerably, according to Bond scholar Stephen J. Rubin. Ian Fleming, James Bond's creator, was born in London in 1908, and in the 1930s had distinguished himself with his coverage of an espionage trial in Moscow for Reuters. His command of detail and ability to convey atmosphere with words delighted his readers and editors. During World War II, he was, as we've since learned, deeply involved in counterintelligence activities on behalf of the British government, and was associated with Sir William Stevenson, the spymaster known as Intrepid. Oddly enough, Stevenson was later portrayed on television by David Niven, one of those actors on the wish list to play Bond in the late 1950s and early 1960s. In fact, David Niven did play James Bond in the spoof Casino Royale in 1966. In 1944, while on wartime leave, Fleming became enamored of a piece of beachfront property in Jamaica and persuaded an American friend to purchase a strip of land for him. This became his retreat, Goldeneye. It was only a few miles from the major exterior locations used in Dr. No.
Jack Lord was the best of all the Felix Leiters they had. I liked him very much. He was a very efficient actor. Very efficient.
Fleming wrote his first Bond book, Casino Royale, in 1952. In 1954, Casino Royale was brought to television in a one-hour dramatization starring Barry Nelson as an American agent named James Bond. Actor-producer Ian Hunter considered acquiring the rights to the Bond titles, and actor-producer Gregory Ratoff did buy the rights to Casino Royale, but died before he could do anything with the picture. Those rights sold to Charles K. Feldman, who produced the spoof Casino Royale. Henry Morgenthau, the financier, suggested to Fleming a television series called Commander Jamaica. Although nothing developed from it, the storyline that Fleming worked on for the pilot became the basis for Dr. No.
That's a black dashboard and steering wheel, and in fact he's driving a red dashboard and steering wheel. But we won't go into those things, will we? What happened was, because of the weather and the problems, we picked up inserts in other places, and I used them where perhaps they weren't supposed to be used. Your eye doesn't go to the black of the thing. Your eye goes to what I want you to look at, which is the speedometer. It's a perfect example of editing lessons, if you like. You can do murderous things. You can do terrible continuity things, and it really doesn't matter as long as you take the audience's eye to what you want them to see.
That particular introduction, you have a man's reaction. You wonder what the hell he's reacting to. And the camera pulls back and he's reacting to a gun in his back, you know. As I say now, you see it once a week in some show or other, but that was actually, I think, the first time it had been done. My background is somewhat similar to the James Bond background. I was actually in intelligence during the war. I served in the Guards Armor Division in a tank. I think I went to the right schools and I went to Cambridge. At least I knew how these people behaved. And so much of the Bond films is behavior, really. Sean is also wearing a very elegant grey flannel suit. Spoiled by putting his gun in his pocket.
Get up.
It's bad matching, if you notice. He swung at him with his right and hit him with his left, but that's not my problem. He was one of the first cool people in pictures, you see. There was a lot of cool in these films. Nowadays, I say, God, it's... One forgets this is nearly 30 years ago, you know. It's a long time.
And this was considered a very violent scene. I remember having discussions with the censors, certainly in England, about this. But today, you wouldn't think this was violent. That, I think, is the government office in Jamaica.
This was... Sean and I used to add... In fact, I'd say 90% of the humour in the Bond film, Sean and I put in. This was something that we did just as Sean was going in. Sean said, what should I say? You know, I'm James Bond. I said, no, just say, keep an eye on him, make sure he doesn't get away with it. Another revamp by Mr. Adam. I think that's also part of the casino. One part of the casino. Now, this guy was, I think, the head of the police there, if I remember rightly. Great, very keen amateur actor.
But I must tell you that this whole style that he was dressed in, the half-inch cuffs below the sleeve of the suit, was all done by Terence. That was Terence Young. So this is all straightforward plot things. Hey, he's now... this is really the storyline. Here he is trying to find out what happened to Strangeways, and he's piecing together the mystery of the whole thing.
Richard Maybaum, born in New York in 1909, is the writer responsible for transforming Fleming's prose into screenplays that allow men like Young, Connery, Adam, and Hunt endless possibilities for invention in pictures like Dr. No. He spoke a bit about his own involvement in the series for the past 28 years and the transformation of Dr. No from the printed page to the big screen.
Richard Maybaum, screenwriter, producer, sometime golfer, and sometime ballet dancer, which is what I've felt like very often in juggling the various graceful and ungraceful actions that are included in the Bond films. I met Cubby Broccoli first when I was recommended to him by Alan Ladd to come over to England with him and make 3 pictures in England. Then when Mr. Broccoli and Mr. Saltzman got together on the Bond pictures, I went to work for them jointly. Cubby had given me several of the Bond novels to read in 1958, I believe. He liked them and I liked them very much. But at that time, we thought perhaps that they were too violent and too sexy because of the codes and stuff like that. So we thought that if you're not going to do them right, let's not do them. But then, you see, the business went kaplunk, and in order to get the customers back, they loosened everything up, and Cubby made this deal with Harry Saltzman, who had a deal with Mr. Fleming, and Cubby told Saltzman about me, and Saltzman says, okay, and so I went over to England and started work on Thunderball, which was to be our first film. There were later became some lawsuits about Thunderball and the rights to them, there having been a previous screenplay written. So it was put aside, and that's why we started with Dr. No. And I'm very glad that we did, because it was a smaller picture, and you didn't have to have been exposed to the Bronze for any long period of time to identify with them. Dr. No is an interesting film in that it's more of a kind of a mystery story, unlike From Russia with Love and Goldfinger. As a matter of fact, all three first pictures had not solidified yet into the form that we eventually ended up with. And we all knew that Dr. No was an interesting and colorful work, but none of us really thought that it was going to be the surprise hit that it later became, for which we are very grateful, of course. I particularly liked Sean in Dr. No because he had all of the attributes that Sean Connery has become famous for, you know, the machismo and the athleticism. But he also at that time had a mischievous modesty. He hadn't assumed that great posture of the great world hero yet, which he filled so well later on. Also, Dr. No had that wonderful girl in it, Ursula Andress. Sean's treatment of her, far from being the roughneck that he later proved to be with a lot of the other female stars, he was very tender and gentle toward her. There weren't many instances of that toward the various ladies that he played, young ladies that he played opposite in the films to come.
Sean, of all the Bonds, I feel has to be categorized as the best. It's not really a fair competition, because he got in first, and so everybody's image would have been touched by that, would have been affected by that. But Sean does fit physically better than any of them the description of Bond by Fleming: lean, dark, sardonically looking. We didn't put the scar on him. There's meant to be a small scar in the books. And above all, he's a very good actor, which is something people don't really take into consideration. They're only now, after all these years, realizing what a good actor he is. The man in the background, this was a lovely man, Johnny Kitzmuller. I'd seen him in a film of Vittorio De Sica's of Rossellini's called Paisan. He played a wonderful scene there with the little boy who steals his boots, and he goes in the slums of Naples and finally tracks the kid down.
I thought you might be able to tell me what happened to him.
As far as I know, nothing happened. Unless you know different, Captain.
Where did you take him, in your boat?
See that, Captain? That there's the Caribbean. That's where. Fishing.
I'm interested in fishing. I'd like to charter your boat.
I'm sorry, Captain. It's not for hire.
Seems I came to the wrong address.
That's all right, Captain. Now, if you'll excuse me, I got business to attend to.
I must say, you know, the locations and all that were lovely that we had down there in Jamaica. Really lovely. It was not easy. It was very tricky, this business of getting to see our Russians. In fact, I saw very little of them, and when I did, I saw them without sound.
The two actors in this scene with Sean Connery are Lester Prendergast, who plays Puss Feller, and who really was the owner of the bar, and John Kitzmiller, who plays Quarrel. Although most Bond viewers may only know John Kitzmiller from this film, he was one of the most important and visible of black actors in international cinema from 1946 right up until his death from cirrhosis of the liver in 1965. John Kitzmiller was born in Battle Creek, Michigan in 1913 and trained as an engineer. He served in World War II as a lieutenant in the Army Corps of Engineers, and it was one day in Italy during 1945 that he was discovered by director Roberto Rossellini while in his barracks and given a role in the film Paisan. Kitzmiller got good notices and discovered that he liked acting. What's more, he liked living in Italy, where he suffered none of the indignities of American racism. He once told an interviewer for a local newspaper he could register in any hotel in Rome with a good deal less trouble than he could in Battle Creek, Michigan.
This is actually shot in a little cafe. No, I give a lot of credit to Terrence because when I did it, you know, I said, listen, Terrence, you're a bad boy. You know, you don't give me enough material in one thing. Oh, it was very difficult, dear boy. You say very difficult. The weather was terrible. He always had lots of music. And I used to say, well, give me a little bit more. Don't be so quick in saying cut. Give me something on the end. That is all I had, virtually cut before they finished their action because Terrence, that's the way he worked. I had to bash this all together. I quite like the way it's all bashed together because it makes it very sort of comic strippy, which is what I thought. And he said to me, that's very good, that's very good.
This is a very neatly written and directed sequence. Terrence Young has gotten to pull his little trick with the reaction shot before revealing the gun again. And Richard Maybaum has used the Walter PPK as the calling card between the American CIA agent and the British Secret Service agent. It's a bit of cinematic shorthand that really could only work in a picture that's directed and edited as breezily as this.
I don't like to shoot in master shots. I shoot John Ford was my godfather and my mentor in the film business. And I think you'll find that in Dr. No, I used about 90,000 feet of film as opposed to the 150 and 200 that's standard. With Willie Wyler, there'd always be a million feet of film. Same with George Stevens. Same with Anatole Litvak, same with John Huston. I like to shoot the bits that I'm going to use. I mean, it's stupid shooting a whole sequence in master shot when it's quite obvious that you're going to use it for the entrance and maybe for the exit. But you can't play the real dialogue bits in anything except a medium and close shot. And so I shoot very little film. In fact, I'm a bit stupid because I should shoot more. Very often you need something for your editing afterwards and you haven't got it.
It's a real nightclub featuring Byron Lee and his all-Chinese band and the song Jump Up, Jump Up, which was released as sheet music.
I think that's Chris Blackwell, that blondish boy there. I had as an assistant there a young Jamaican, a white Jamaican, but he's been there for four generations. And he had a Jamaican passport called Chris Blackwell, who came to me after the shooting of this picture and asked me if I'd lend him or whether I'd invest £5,000 in a record company he wanted to start for all the Jamaicans in England. He was going to just get music that they would like and take it round in the back of his car and sell it. So I said, yes, I'd do it. And he brought his partner. I said, but I'd like to meet the partner. If I'm going to be a director of your company, I'd like to see who I'm in bed with. And the next day, this chap showed up with Chris. Chris came with him. And they were both absolutely high as kites on pot and something else, I don't know what. And my wife said, look, don't touch it. You're going to, you know, these boys are not safe. All I can tell you is that Island Records was sold about 6 months ago for $400 million. So it wasn't a very good decision on my part. But he's a lovely man, very nice person.
John Kitzmiller, by the way, made a second movie in 1946, To Live in Peace, directed by Luigi Zampa, and then starred in Without Pity. And in 1950, he was the star of the first film directed by Federico Fellini, Variety Lights. In 1957, he won the Best Actor Award at the Cannes Film Festival for his performance in Dolina Mira.
This was the Miss Jamaica that we acquired. She was a very beautiful, as you can see, a beautiful woman. Don't think she'd ever acted in her life before. She was awfully good. This guy was the owner of the nightclub, and I think he was I hope he's not alive still, but I thought he was quite an operator in some form or other. Nearly all our costumes were made by a Jamaican girl, fun enough, instead of having a designer from England. There was a girl called Tessa Wellborn, and she was the niece of the rather sinister barman I've just been talking about, or second cousin. And she did all these costumes. And I, having been born in China, I'm a great believer in the Cheongsam. I think it's one of the most elegant things you can possibly wear. And so we put Ursula into one later, and we use here as well.
Also at the table is Jack Lord, about whom Young had some more thoughts and recollections.
This picture did him too much good. He got offered a thing called Stony Broke or something. He paid a rodeo. No, he did something else before that, but he was inundated with TV offers immediately after. I knew this picture was going to be a success, that's all I can tell you. I mean, you know. But we thought it was going to be a success that would get his money back in 6 months or 9 months and make a little profit. And I thought it would be good enough to carry a second film and maybe a third if we were lucky. But I never thought it would go beyond three films. Neither did the producers.
Now we're about to come up on the assassination attempt against Bond. It features a very subtle piece of trickery by Peter Hunt. It's covered very nicely in the music, and it reveals a great deal about the editor's art, apart from making a film tighter or making a scene flow better. Sometimes they can make the scene work altogether.
Doctor No. Here come our three blind mice, or two of them. One got killed somewhere. The actual car coming round with the headlights didn't really work, but I made it work by flaring the film on these guys. I hadn't got a shot of the car with the headlights going across camera, which would have cut in with that and made it absolutely sure and obvious. You see, I flared the film in the laboratories there to get the idea of the car coming up, because I didn't have a shot of the car coming up.
Please.
Have you an appointment, sir?
I'll tell him it's James Bond. We met yesterday at the Queen's Club.
Very well. He's somewhere in the lab.
Anthony Dawson, who plays Professor Dent in Dr. No, is a Scottish-born actor who trained at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. Although primarily a stage performer, his screen work includes Anthony Asquith's The Way to the Stars and the would-be murderer-turned-victim in Alfred Hitchcock's Dial M for Murder, a role that he originated in the stage version. Curiously enough, in From Russia with Love, he was the first man to play Ernst Stavro Blofeld, with his back to the camera and his voice dubbed by Eric Pullman. Peter Hunt picks up the commentary on Dawson, Dent, and Dr. No.
He's a great friend of Terence's, and Terence used him as understudies, as extra. I mean, Terence used him all over the place, wherever he could. And he went out with them because he was a good all-rounder, and they gave him that part. He's quite a good actor, and he lives in Italy. It was a big family, it became. And you must remember, I worked with these producers for 11 years, continuously. I got to the position where they practically thought, you know, if they wanted their car cleaned, oh, Peter Hunt will do that, you know. Anything that was difficult or wanted to be done, you know, you find them say, well, give it to Peter Hunt, he'll do that. And so I found myself doing all sorts of odd jobs within the film. And it was great experience, tremendous experience. But when I came to direct my own film, I'd done so much bits and pieces and second units and chases and all that sort of thing, that I just walked straight into it. It was not an effort for me. It's more an effort to do a film now, because I realize more how difficult it is. Then I had such support of a group of people around me, the two producers. As he gets on that they shot in Jamaica. Now that was built at Pinewood Studios as a model on the tank, and Terence suddenly said, we need something that's moving, and went off and bought two little toy boats, which he put into the tank. And then I was able to cut them in relation to that, and cut them in relation to that, which is real. All this is real, with the boats where they shot in Jamaica. So I was able to mix the two. So you got the establishing shot. I didn't spend any time on location on Dr. No. At one point I was going to go out to Jamaica, but that really there was no reason. And it was a very hard location shoot. They were having very bad weather problems. And remember, you know, we didn't have all that money to play with. Later we had money to play with when we became very successful. This is the box I might. This is a good piece of work. This was a great shot, I always thought. I liked that very much. And I put a lovely soundtrack on it, of the footsteps clang, 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 clanging away. And I felt that it was a good introduction to this scene. again, which is a masterpiece of imagination on the part of Ken Adam, the art director.
At that time, I was already very low on budget and so on. I had, I think, £475 left for this set. So I came up with the idea of this enormous grill in a circular opening, an empty set with a stylized chair, and you know, I knew it would give interesting possibilities to Ted Moore, the lighting cameraman, in terms of black and white and contrast and shadow effects. And it was a complete stylization. I mean, it was not based in a way on a real room or reality, and I always liked to work on most films in this manner. And it turned out to be a very effective set. So the whole idea of that grid in the ceiling and the reflection on the walls was like a spider's web.
I had the idea of that thing on the top because there's only two sides. There isn't anything else. There's no reverse shot. Everything is shot at this angle. I remember when I was working for Alexander Korda many years ago, they'd built an enormous set with a piece of staircase and a great big thing showing the cathedral windows. And you really got the impression that you were in a medieval palace, you know, and it was literally a thing about the size of this set.
The contrast here works so well. It's the juxtapositioning of two complete opposites. I mean, here you have a completely utilitarian set, which is very effective, and you cut immediately to the luxury and the elegance of Jamaica, as it were, of a very expensive hotel. Sean was pretty average. He didn't like to do anything that was too dangerous, or that he thought might be dangerous, you know. He didn't like, and quite rightly so, like many actors, they don't want to, and neither does the production, want them to injure themselves in any way, so that, you know, he had to be careful. They all have to be careful from an insurance point of view. But he wasn't like Burt Lancaster, you know, who would get out there and do it, who'd been a trapeze artist and could really enjoy doing it. He didn't do that. On the other hand, if you asked him to do something that was fairly straightforward, he would do that. If you ask him to do something that he thought was complicated or a little bit dangerous, like hanging on the wing of a plane or something, no way, you know, or falling out of a fast-driving car or things like that, no way, he'd say, get a stuntman.
The next tricky thing was how to get Sean and a spider together, because it was a real tarantula. I had a double there called Bob Simmons, who always used to double, and it's his flesh that is crawling over. The only way we could get the tarantula to crawl over Sean and have Sean in it, we had to have a glass plate in between. The problem then is that shooting from the side, you wouldn't, the tarantula would have slid off the glass. You had to put it on a horizontal plane. To do that, we had to put the bed on its side, so that where the carpet was, we had to put wallpaper and a wall and a chair that was nailed up. You see very little of it, actually. I don't know why we went to all that trouble. We had to strap him in the bed. In fact, he lay on a kind of a bench that was strapped in there. It took a lot of coaxing. And we had to push it with air. We had a little air thing to make him go in the right direction.
Now that's terrific, isn't it? Do you know how that is? That's done by a glass, shooting down through above, through a glass, with the scorpion on the glass, walking up the arm, with Sean underneath the glass. But quite safe. That's for real. That's, I think, and Bob Simmons or somebody who... They promised they'd taken the venom out of the snake, and he, very bravely, but that's not Sean's arm, of course. Very good, that was. Extremely well done. There, now I have fun. bang, 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 and the orchestra does the same with it. I did that with John Barry. Various people said, oh, come on. I said, no, they'll love it. There's a quick fade out. There's a perfect example of how you can use a fade out. I always remember Bill Hornbeck, who was an American editor, who said, never use a fade out. Gives the audience time to ruffle up in their seats and become restless. Keep the thing moving, he always used to say. But those days, they used to do great long fade outs with big black lumps. I don't like them knowing any of these tricks, you know. I hate it when you see films about how films are made. I personally like it all to remain an illusion. This is the illusion of drama, the illusion of cinema, the illusion. You go into a darkened cinema and you sit on your own and you identify with the characters on the screen. And this is what we've been fast losing over the last decade or so. And of course, with the advent of television, where grandma's making the tea and somebody else is talking and all that sort of, but we've lost that illusion. Now we all become visually orientated.
The film Dr. No seems an almost perfect realization of Fleming's book. Richard Maybaum was asked what Fleming's attitudes were toward the screenplays and the films.
I had the feeling that Mr. Fleming was a bit of a snob. That's all that I felt about it, but a tremendously talented man, much a greater writer than most people gave him credit for. His descriptions and character studies and all those things, simply marvelous, really. And I had and still have great admiration for him. He just didn't seem very interested in the writing aspects of the things, which was odd, but he got bored with them, I think. He got bored with the books after a while, and the books showed it, too. I think the thing that the best of them all was, of course, not Dr. No, but On Her Majesty's Secret Service, by far the best novel he ever wrote. He didn't seem very interested in them, in anything. I think he read the scripts, the screenplays, and then would write little marginal notes about that in the club. And James Bond would call M one thing, when in the office, of course, he'd be much more formal about him and stuff like that. And the only thing he ever asked me about from Russia with Love was when he met me during the time we were shooting that, he said to me one question. He said, are the rats in? You know the scene where this rat stampede in the cellar of the thing? That was the only question he ever asked me, are the rats in? And then, of course, he did say, your screenplays are so much funnier than my books. I don't know why. I should have told him because we tried to make them funnier.
Dr. No had actually followed an extremely circuitous route to the screen in terms of its plot elements. At one point, Wolf Mankiewicz, the British author and playwright best known for the films A Kid for Two Farthings and Espresso Bongo, had worked on the screenplay, before Terence Young managed to pull it all back together.
When I came onto the picture, there were four scripts. The last one was written by quite a good writer. He wrote a couple of quite interesting English films. But Dr. No had become a chimpanzee. Don't laugh. He was a monkey, an ape. And we were about 2 weeks short of going on location. And Cubby Broccoli said, look, I know Terence writes quickly. And I was locked up in a hotel suite in the in London, the Dorchester. And I rewrote the script going back to the book. We used much more of the book than it was originally in the other script. And we went back, I'd say, to about 75%, if not more, back to the original story. And this is one of the things that always surprises me. You make a film, you spend a lot of money buying a book, and then you hire 10 other writers to get as far away from the book as you possibly can.
All right. You leave the Port Royal Road out of Kingston, then along the Windward Road, until you get to the cement factory.
Now, this is something that we put in afterwards. this long dissolve with her voice going over it. It, of course, has become very commonplace today to do this sort of thing. But on that day, now her voice carries on, and she, as he's driving up, she's giving him directions where to go. That's a double drive in the car, if you look very closely. This is a little bit of BP. That, I didn't remember that. That's back projection. Oh, I do remember. We had to have this because he goes under this crane in a minute. It's good back projection. Charles Staffel at Pinewood Studios, I think you're right. Excellent man. Excellent technician. This is the improbable. Impossible. That's back projection under there.
I didn't know how to get the car off the little car pushing a big, big car off the road. I mean, it doesn't make sense, you know. Sean suddenly sees this thing here, and I suddenly got the idea that that would be a good way to get the big truck onto the road, if the car would pass under the arm. Well, we said to Sean, come on, drive up and let's see, and it cleared it by about that much. So I said, action, and as the car came around the corner, it was bouncing on the road, and it was going about a foot and a half off the road, not 4 inches. And I tried to shout, stop it, but there was no way. And I just honestly prayed like that. And I said, please, God, please, God. And he bounced just before, and he came down just under, and he went under. I was nearly killed at the bottom here. That's me with the camera here. And but for a clever assistant who dragged me out of the way, I would have been killed because I had my eye on the eyepiece and the camera was hit by the camera was hit by the car. Now, this guy was the real driver, and I'd given him $25 to let us shoot the scene. And I said, do you want to make another quick $10? And he said, yes. And he comes up and he says, what happened? And he got a bad laugh because it was so stupid. It was one of those stupid things you don't think of at the time. Then when we went back to the dubbing theater, we used another voice in any case for him, and someone said, how did it happen? And then Sean says, I don't know, this is one of the goodies we kicked up on the thing, because none of the scene was in the picture. And he just said, I don't know, I think they're on their way to a funeral. And got an enormous laugh. Only because of the changing of what happened got a wrong laugh. It was a bad laugh from the house. And twisting it round, it got a big laugh, and a big laugh at the end of a scene carries you over a long time. It carries you halfway through the next scene. And I learned that from the Cary Grant comedies. It worked awfully well at that particular time. The only other thing about it was the governor of Nassau, of the Bahamas, came to watch a shooting. We broke for lunch just after that. God, was I relieved. Oh, God, was I relieved. And the governor arrived with his wife and everything. It was a frightfully hot day. And Sean had taken off his trousers to keep cool. He was perfectly dressed up to there. But Sean came alongside, and we said, can we present you to Lady Brennan? And he said, yes. And he jumped out of the car. He didn't even have a jockstrap on. She said, my dear, said like that. And anyway, he said, oh, blah, blah, blah. So they got him a towel and put his trousers on, and the thing went on.
It's rather beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Dummy, do you always wear it up?
Don't you like it that way?
Yes, very much.
Nice Bondian touch. Zena Marshall, she's a famous actress. She made a lot of pictures in England during the 40s and 50s. Along with people like Phyllis Calvert, Margaret Lockwood, and those sort of people, she was well known. That's a wig she's wearing to give her a sort of oriental look. And she's a good actress. I suppose today you'd have had a love scene in there. You'd have had two bodies naked rolling around with one another. Well, I mean, even in those days we had quite a heavy sentence. You never got that close from the censor's point of view. But I don't think you miss it. Somehow there's a sexuality about it all.
Forget it. May I use your phone?
She was a friend of mine. I got a lot of my friends into these pictures. There was a gag in this that we did We didn't have it in about 4 or 5 takes. It was just in the last take, and we nearly didn't use it, but it was very effective. So when he's screwing her, or about to, he looks at his watch, and he got a howl of laughter, so we left it in. We were doubtful about it, you know, it was one of those things.
Explains what?
Why you need a taxi.
Why I need a taxi?
Careful, my nail vanished.
The villain from whose clutches Bond has just escaped was played by Zena Marshall, an Anglo-French performer whose own life might have made a fascinating book. She was raised on her father's estate in Africa, and at age 12 was sent by her mother to a convent in France and later to another convent in Belgium. In 1940, she was aboard a train from Antwerp to Brussels just as the Nazis began their blitzkrieg of Belgium, and found herself seemingly safe in a railway car with 5 priests. Shades of Ian Fleming, those priests turned out to be Nazi paratroopers in disguise. She was evacuated to Glasgow and spent much of the war on her father's estate, Skeffington Hall, in Leicestershire. Zena Marshall, by the way, began her screen career in 1945 with Caesar and Cleopatra and played small roles in dramas such as Good Time Girl. Curiously enough, in 1953, one of her first starring vehicles, The Caretaker's Daughter, was released in America paired with The Frightened Bride, which had been directed by Terence Young. During the late 1960s, she also achieved some fame as the plaintiff in a divorce case that proved to be the longest such trial in the entire history of English law.
This really projected Sean into a star sort of character. And as he went on and did these films, so of course he got more famous, more well known, and more confidence, and now he's a fine actor. Now he's a big international star. But at the time we made this film, you have to remember, he was hardly known at all. I was editing a film called On the Fiddle, before Dr. No, when Harry came with me. And the producer of On the Fiddle was a man called Ben Fish, who was a Polish gentleman. He wasn't a Polish producer, he was a British producer. And a very nice man. And Harry Saltzman has some sort of Polish connection in the background. And we were all having dinner, I think, at the Polish club in London, when Harry came in and joined us with his wife and various people, and announced that he was going to make a James Bond film of the Ian Fleming books, and that they were looking for somebody to play James Bond, and they'd been testing people and one thing or another. And it was Ben Fish who turned to me and said, "What about that Sean Connery? Don't you think he might make a good Bond?" And I said, "Yes, I think he might. Would Harry like to see a reel or two of our film?" He said, "Yes, he would." And I sent it up to him to see, and I don't know what went on behind closed doors or how it was constructed, but the upshot of all that was that they cast Sean, who you must remember was not a star. He was the supporting actor in On the Fiddle.
Now we've come to a scene that created one of the few censor problems that Dr. No encountered. Peter Hunt talks a bit about the difficulty that they had in doing away with Professor Dent.
Here was a censor problem we had, because we shot Anthony Dawson. I'm not sure how many bullets we finally used, but repeater bullets, like 3 or 4 times, bang, 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 bang. And everybody, the censor at that time, thought that this was too brutal and horrific. And I have a feeling in some countries it was cut. I mean, it was just one shot.
Mr. Smith and Wesson. And you've had your 6.
There we go. 1, 2, 3. Oh, yes, there's only 2 on that. Yes, I think it was 3 or 4 originally, which I had on, and maybe we cut the just down to 2 and got away with the censor on that. The gun. It was also early days for showing a pistol with a silencer on, too. I remember there was a great deal of discussion about that.
A lot of people said we were nasty to shoot, that it showed Sean as being a very nasty man, that he shoots the other man in cold blood half a dozen times, you know. My argument to that was the man had tried to kill him 3 seconds earlier. You know, I don't think he deserved to be treated very nicely. That was a line we had to put in. You had your six, because they didn't. The audience wouldn't have understood what we meant by, you know, why he was able to sit there in impunity. This is something that always distresses me in pictures, is day for night. You go to such enormous lengths to make it look vaguely day for night. And then they do, your show copies are wonderful. Your show copies are, the ones you show in, you know, Radio City Music Hall and all that, absolutely impeccable. Then when they go out into general distribution, you could be in broad daylight. They just don't give a damn. They just make the prints, you see, on a certain printing number, and even with computers, it's better now because you can. But they don't bother. They haven't time. They're going to make 2,000 prints in 5 days or 8 days or something.
Yes, that was day for night, yes. Day for night that we had a lot of trouble with, if I remember. Oh, it eventually got right. Everybody had an opinion about how dark or how light it should be. It seemed to look all right on television. That was a great thing. Oh, you'll never be able to see it on television.
Orson Welles once said, there are two great entrances in the cinema, Omar Sharif in Lawrence of Arabia and Ursula Andress in Dr. No. I was in a nightclub in Paris, and in the crowd was Daryl Zanuck dancing with Greco. Do you remember Juliet Greco, who was his mistress at the time? Daryl said, how you doing, kid? And I said, fine, because I'd known him. I'd made a picture for Fox before that. In fact, I was under contract to the studio for a time. And Daryl said, what are you doing tomorrow for lunch? And I said, nothing. He said, come and have lunch with me, 1 o'clock, pronto, 1 o'clock, I arrive. So he said, come on in. I'll go and have a shower and shave and clean up. Go on into the sitting room, he said. There are about 50 lousy scripts. He said, there are about 200 telegrams and telexes, and there are a lot of letters and a lot of photographs. Take what you want. So I looked at one or two of the letters, the telexes. They were rather boring. I started to turn over the pictures. I would say there must have been 200 pictures all around his desk, piles and like that. And there must have been certainly 50 girls who had a wet shirt on. And there was Ursula. So I took it, and I went round to the bathroom, and I shouted to Daryl. I said, who is the girl in the wet shirt? And he said, Ursula Andress. So I said, that girl's going to be a star. If he remembers just one name, one face. I said, can I keep the picture? He said, yeah, sure, take it. Take them. He said, we're not going to use any of those people. I went back to London, and I gave this to Cubby and Harry, and they looked at it, and they liked it. You couldn't not like it. She looked marvelous. We had lots of other pictures then, and then Harry and Cubby shared a big desk and was piled with them. Every morning I used to go by their office on my way up to my office, and I used to put Ursula's picture on the top. And this went on for 2 weeks. We dragged on for another 2 weeks, and we still didn't have a leading lady. And then, out of sheer desperation, Cubby called the head of Columbia's casting or talent department, a fellow called Max Arno, and he said to Max, would you have a look at this girl and tell us what you think? So she came in to see him, and Max Arno said, look, I can't tell you if she can act or not, but my God, she looks great. So Cubby said, that's it. And they did a deal with her agent. They paid her fare from Los Angeles to New York. They gave her $1,000 on top, and I was to meet her at the airport, and I had a ticket to take her to Jamaica or her return ticket to L.A., and I took one look at her, and I said, where's your luggage? Put it, and we took it to Jamaica. That's how Ursula got this part.
It's been a constant source of confusion as to who wrote the score for this film and the extraordinary James Bond theme with which it opens. Monty Norman is officially credited with the film, but apart from Underneath the Mango Tree and Jump Up, Jump Up, he had relatively little to do with the score for Dr. No as it was finally released. And John Barry wrote the James Bond theme, although he was not permitted to claim authorship as Norman was contracted for the score. At the time, John Barry was the leader of the John Barry Seven, a light jazz outfit that, since the mid-1950s, had enjoyed a great deal of success on the British pop charts. They were competitors to the famed rock instrumental trio, The Shadows, and had their own guitar sound, courtesy of guitarist Vic Flick. According to John Barry, it was a friend at United Artists Publishing, which published two recent hits of his, who recommended him to Saltzman and Broccoli when he heard that they were unhappy with the theme Norman had come up with. Barry recalls getting a telephone call on a Friday, coming to a Saturday meeting that was attended by Monty Norman and the two producers, being given the length of the music cue they were looking for, and turning in the finished theme on the following Tuesday. He borrowed liberally from a couple of his earlier hits, which, not having been hits in the United States, made the resulting theme sound even fresher. He made good use of Vic Flick's guitar dexterity, and came up with what is arguably one of the great movie themes of all time. Oddly enough, John Barry never did see Dr. No before writing the theme, and had nothing to do with the rest of the picture. The soundtrack album, in addition to the James Bond theme, features a few guitar instrumentals sandwiched in between different versions of Underneath the Mango Tree, and is one of the strangest soundtracks to come out of the Bond series, if only for the relatively small amount of material actually from the movie that appears on it. We'll talk more about John Barry on From Russia with Love, the first Bond film that he scored completely, and Goldfinger, the first of the Bond films to yield a major hit song. Ian Fleming also figured in the shooting in Jamaica, where he happened to appear one day. Terrence Young tells us a little bit about his relationship with the originator of James Bond.
Relationship started off in a rather shaky, thorny beginning. United Artists gave a big cocktail party at the Savoy Hotel to launch the James Bond series. And at this party, naturally enough, Ian Fleming was there. And he came across with Cubby Broccoli, who introduced us, and we were talking for a few minutes, and he said, yes, he said, you're the director, you're the man who's going to spoil my books, he said, with your directorial touches. I said, Mr. Fleming, I don't know about you, but I said, my last film won the gold medal at the Venice Film Festival. I don't know what prizes your books have ever read. He said, my God, you're a prickly customer, aren't you? And I said, no. I think he was a little bit drunk at the moment, too. I said, but, you know, we should do everything we can to make your books a big success. So he said, well, anyway, nice to meet you. But when Dr. No came out, or while we were shooting it, we were in Jamaica. And one of the days, funny enough, it was the day we were shooting Ursula Andress coming out of the water. We then had a scene where she ran across the beach, and who should we see in the distance coming, chatting gaily away? Three very English-looking gents. So we waved at them and all sorts of thing, and they fell down in the sand. And when we said cut, they came forward looking rather sheepish. They were Noel Coward, a famous English, a very intellectual writer and essayist called Peter Quinnell, who was the editor of, like, the New Republican in this country, and Ian Fleming. And at the lunch, we all got very high together. It was a very good lunch sitting out in the open. And they were absolutely fascinated because he thought that Ursula was even better than his honey child rider in the book. And he said, would I like to go out and have dinner at the house, which I did. And then I used to go up there two or three times a week. Noel was usually there. And in fact, I asked Noel to speak to Sean. I said, Sean must realize that it's not enough to be a good actor these days. You've got to help and, you know, collaborate with the press and all sorts of things. And I said, you know, you should tell him not to go to the governor's house wearing a wind cheater, you know, it's not the best. So Noel gave him a kind of talking to, which I think helped a lot. But I then became very friendly with Ian. We used to have lunch together every Thursday. I lived in France, and he lived by the sea in Sandwich on a golf course in the south of England. And he used to come up every Thursday to do business, and every Thursday that I was in London, we used to meet at the Connaught Hotel. Now, Ian has this enormous aura about him of being a tremendous gourmet because of the meals he describes and the splendid wines that you drink. But every lunch we ever had and every meal I've ever had with him was the same. He used to have scrambled eggs, and then he used to have about four large brandies and ginger ale. So much for this great gourmet. And I used to feel very embarrassed because I'd be having a damn good, we'd take weeks, alternate weeks to pay, you know. And I felt terribly guilty, you know, and after this had been going on for about a year, I said, look here, this is silly. I must do three at a time and you do one because, you know, I'm having wine, I'm having a four-course lunch and everything. He said, dear boy, he said, you've made me a very rich man. He said, you know, I'll keep on like this, he said. And unfortunately he died after From Russia With Love. He came out to Istanbul. Now, the funny thing is he'd never been there, although he wrote about it very knowledgeably. He'd never been there before, as he told me. And he came and stayed with my wife and myself. We'd taken a part of a hotel for ourselves. I didn't stay at the Hilton with the rest of the crew. I like to be alone if I can.
As Dr. No progresses, it's impossible not to appreciate the locales we've been watching, particularly the scenes at Crab Key, which were actually part of an estate very near the place where Fleming and Coward both lived. These shots of Connery, Andress, and Kitzmiller breathing through hollow reeds, by the way, were all done at Pine Wood in London, according to Terence Young.
I had to shoot the close shots of this and them in the... This was all concocted. None of this is in the script. We just put all this in because it looked exciting, the location. The close-ups of them with the weed, sucking the weed, we had to shoot in the studio afterwards because I didn't have enough time. I shot the whole of the sequence in one day. I had about 10 weeks for the whole film. Here we get the wet shirt syndrome. You'll notice what a damn good physique Sean had, and which none of the others have had, I'm afraid. He was a weightlifter and a bodybuilder in those days. Now he's a golfer. I taught him to play golf.
I imagine, you know, that is in keeping with Bond's self-preservation. He doesn't want to get caught, and he has to be ruthless. He's fairly ruthless about Professor, the guy he shoots in the scene previously with the bullets. I know that it's done in a way that makes it look like it's self-preservation again, because he goes for his pistol and the other, and Bond then shoots him. But I think Bond is fairly ruthless. I don't think that he's ever been portrayed as, if you put him in a corner, you're not going to get something very ruthless out of him to get him out of a problem or a hole.
Now.
Look at me. We had to loop all of this. It was terrific noise from that thing. The sound man going mad. I mean, we hardly could get a... Because there were no mics. Throat mics or anything like that. Radio mics there. And we had enough trouble getting a guide track.
We'll be out of here by midnight.
I never met a detective before. Are you going to arrest Dr. No?
Well, someone is. We can't have him trying to kill everyone who comes here.
Shooting in Jamaica had its advantages, both to the film as you see before you and to Jamaica.
When we went to Jamaica and we made this picture, there were 800 hotel bedrooms in Jamaica. One year after Dr. No, there were 4,000. When we went to Istanbul, there were only about 500 first-class hotel rooms. And 2 years afterwards, there were nearly 3,000.
And didn't the police investigate? And what about your family?
Well, they investigated for a long time. Then they said missing, presumed dead. I haven't got any family. There was only my father and me.
You mean you're here?
Peter Hunt has his own recollections about Ursula Andress and the Jamaica shoot.
She'd done things before in French films and... She'd done parts before. She wasn't very well known here. She wasn't known internationally, perhaps. The whole idea of her walking out of the sea at that moment and being dressed like that was very appealing. I find it rather old-fashioned now to look at it. I mean, Bo Derek would have come out with nothing on.
Well, you know, I scratched his face... And then, but he was stronger than I was.
Esther's voice was difficult to understand. Remember too, it was very early on for Ursula. I mean, Ursula later learned English much, much better and went on to use her own voice in a number of films after this. But there were certain areas in it that you couldn't understand quite what she said, and we said for clarity, we used the little Monica van der Zyl, her name was, as her voice. But it suited her, it was her voice all right. She was very pretty, very beautiful girl. Nice girl too, very funny, lovely personality. This was to give a nice passage of time, and I tried to get away from... I tried to make it a little different and a little bit more interesting. And with the sound effects over this, they helped a great deal. And of course, it got us from one side of the island in the story to the other side of the island, and really into the contaminated area of all this mud and mire, and the sequence with this highly improbable tank and these guys dressed in protective clothing. I don't think that if you really ask him, Terence liked this tank. And I think it was a thorn in his side. I don't think he quite liked the idea of this. The weather turned bad on them and they weren't able to get all the material that they should have been able to make this work. But it does work. It works very well, funnily enough. And I think he was, you know, very difficult to try and make this believable. So again, here comes the pace of the cutting. The pace of the cutting and the sort of effects behind it made it more believable. If you analyze it silent, if you just look at it without any sound, it really isn't very, very believable.
This was a kind of a... I can't remember what it was. It was a buggy, a dune buggy with a rather corny thing in front of it, but it was not really much good. We didn't have any money to do anything better than this. We were lucky enough to have the flamethrower. Actually, what Ken Adam did in this picture is really quite remarkable, I must say. He's never done it before or since, in my opinion. I mean, I thought the sets in Strangelove were interesting, but, I mean, he had all the money in the world for them, you know, and I don't know how he did this. An awful lot of revamping, one set, but this wall would be painted something else and be used for another part of the forest, you know.
The dragon is a reminder, however, after the almost playful interlude with Honey Rider, in which Bond has more than held his own against the enemy, that this is a violent action film. Quarrel's death, in particular, is the most violent single scene in the film, and one of the most brutal deaths depicted in the entire Bond series, at least until Anthony Zerbe's explosive decompression in License to Kill. Like Tilly Masterson's death in Goldfinger, after the almost playful romp in Bond's Aston Martin, it yanks us back to the core of the story, and lends it a certain mythic element here that is played out later in Dr. No. The movie has gone through successive stages of violence also, from covert assassination and assassination attempts to quiet confrontations between the antagonists to this point, when all the cards are about to be laid on the table. Also for the first time, and really the only time until Goldfinger, we see Bond in a situation with which, at the moment, he cannot cope. It's all a lead-in for the explosive grand finale to come, the first of what became a tradition in the Bond pictures, and probably the best until On Her Majesty's Secret Service. We're about to enter the world of Dr. No, where the artistic brilliance of Ken Adam sets the mood for the picture. No's world is futuristic, even by today's standards. There's an element of Jules Verne in it, the atomic power and the functionally high-tech accoutrements sharing space with art treasures in the manner of Captain Nemo from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, or better yet, from Mysterious Island. More than one critic compared Joseph Weissman's Dr. No to James Mason's Captain Nemo, and strangely enough, Mason was also on the wish list of potential James Bonds at one point. Ken Adam talks a bit about his designs.
There, you see, I was experimenting with copper surfaces and slightly, for that time, futuristic planning and glass perspex and shiny floors. And, you know, because obviously the script was very loose about, you know, he had to go through a shower, so they both had to go through a shower to be sprayed down. So I designed this, I think it was like on a treadmill, they going through behind this obscured glass screen. And I had a lot of fun with the set. I don't believe that cluttering a set is necessarily, you know, a good design. It depends, obviously, on what sort of set you design. But, I mean, here the main dramatic impact was that they had to be cleaned of any radioactivity. So, you know, we came up with these panels flashing up and down and moving through this modernistic sort of shower. And so my design, I just played around with those design elements. And I think that is what was important to put over or to show to the audience.
Peter Hunt has his own thoughts on the way in which the structure of the sets enhances the atmosphere and the effectiveness of the film overall.
Here is a very good eye. You see, by pushing them out through there and into the door, we now set the scene, the brickwork, the underwater of them being down below the bauxite mine.
That's really most kind of you. But for the moment...
Of course, you'll be wanting to see your rooms. Breakfast is already ordered, and then you want to sleep. The doctor left strict orders you're not to be disturbed until this evening. He'll be delighted if you'll join him for dinner. Shall I say you'll be there?
Tell him I also will be delighted.
Splendid. I know he'll be pleased. Here we are.
And back to Ken Adam with some more thoughts about the world of Dr. No and the way he created it.
Yes, I must say I feel... you know, seeing it again now, design-wise, that aspect is dated somewhat. But I had a lot of fun with these safe type of doors and juxtaposing them to an underground rock setting and making it look like a rather... you know, elegant hotel of that time, or slightly in the future, and at the same time building up to his eventual confrontation with Dr. No, and now, of course, when I look at it and. You know, I had to do it for a limited budget, and I think it unfortunately does come over to some extent. But I had a lot of fun with it.
It is almost a commonplace in stories of this kind for the heroic intruders into kingdoms such as this to be treated in a royal manner on arrival, whether you're dealing with Flash Gordon or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. In this case, Bond and Honey seem to have arrived at the Dr. No Hilton, but as always, there's more than meets the eye, or in this case, the lips.
I don't feel so good. I feel so scared.
Damn coffee.
This is our first glimpse of the first Bond title villain. Peter Hunt talked a little bit about the beauty of the structure of this sequence.
That's the beginning. Again, setting up Dr. No. Again, setting up the scene in a dramatic way. Look at that. That's really quite good. You know, I mean, what is that? Those black hands? Eventually, it unwinds. So setting the scene again is very good. It worked. It made it all... It set up the scene. I try and set up every scene that you do. Sometimes you can take more time about it, you can be more clever about it. Sometimes you can do it just very quickly and easily and it slips away. You must never do it to the obvious extent that we're doing it now. That's looking at it and analysing it. I do it for the audience who's paid his $3 or $4 and going to the cinema and is going to sit there and be again in the darkness and enthralled with the story. And as long as I make the story work, that's all that matters.
It's almost time for dinner. We don't want to keep the doctor waiting, do we?
Yeah, they gave him one of his old suits. She's wearing a little bit of Chinese, which comes from one of the staff, I suppose. But anyway, it all worked, and it was nice and elegant. Yeah, well, no bra, too, you see. The emphasis of no bra, I guess, in those days was really quite... crazy in those days, that's right. As I say, unfortunately, it's 30 years ago, and we've gone so far forward now.
The sound in this section of the film is also quite different from the sound earlier in the picture. Peter Hunt talked about that.
Yes, well, I tried to make it different because we were so far, you know, to make it underground, to give it a different sort of... feeling, atmosphere, to give it that atmosphere. And later, of course, you know, where he crawls through the tunnel, what do you call it, the air-conditioned viaduct or whatever it is. But this was really quite great because there, the set itself and where it is and everything automatically going was very good. It really was very imaginative. I can remember going down onto the set and seeing all this with Ken Adam, and then over here on the other side there was a great big open space. And I remember saying to Ken, what's that for? Why you got this big open space? This, in fact, it was. Oh, he said, we're going to put glass in there, and we're going, that's the window to the sea. And I said, well, no one told me about that. Well, what are you going to put in the window to the sea? Oh, he said, we'll do back projection. We'll put fish and sea in there. Hey, I said, well, I better find a plate for it, hadn't I? I better find something for it. No one's told me anything about this. Oh, yes, it's always supposed to be like... Oh, I said, well, okay, fine, I better find a plate. And do you know, I couldn't find a plate. I couldn't find a normal-looking plate. That was a plate that came from Disney. And they were these great big fish. And of all the material I found, nothing was really suitable. I showed it to Terence. We couldn't find anything. In the end, he chose this plate. He said, all right, well, let's use that with the big fish. And I said, well, there isn't a lot of it. He said, it doesn't matter, we'll make it work. You know, let's order up a back projection print and we'll use that with the big fish. Okay, I said, it'll look very strange. No, he said, that'll be all right. The glass is magnified. Okay, I said, all right, fine. So I got this material, came from America, had to be flown over. Got it very quickly because they were shooting it very soon. And then there's this wonderful line of dialogue which he injected right there on the spur of the moment. That was a very good moment. Of course, lost today. That portrait had been stolen from the National Gallery in London. And he says, that's where it ended up. It was a long, long time before they could find it. Now, you see, in the background is all that back projection. But every now and again, it ended. So I was continuing. This whole scene was made up of small, short cuts. because the bank rejection kept ending because I didn't have enough of it to run the scene for him. But anyway, we made it work. But the great thing was that right on the spot, when they come over to it and they look at it and you see these big fish swimming around, Terence changed the line of dialogue and Dr. No says, "Minnows pretending to be whales." Which is my favourite line from the film. I always thought it was tremendously funny. And that was his sharpness, you know. He did, and it was a great line. That coupled with the stolen painting worked brilliantly, I thought, in this scene. Made it very much of the time. Lost, unfortunately, 30 years later. And again, you'll see how this is cut, because I couldn't hold it in certain places because the background had gone. I kept getting white flashes. But we made it work. It was a headache. And it worked very well. Dramatically, it worked extremely well.
I see you're wondering why, where, when. I only gratify your curiosity because you're the one man I've met capable of appreciating what I've done.
Terence Young picks up the background on this sequence, followed by Ken Adam recalling how he designed it.
We didn't have the money to build an aquarium in the script, in the story. They built a great big aquarium. So what I did is I got a back projection screen, put it behind water. I made a thin water tank, which was about half the size of one of the, well, about the size of this mirror here. And we put water in it. And we put a back projection screen behind it, and we projected the animals onto the fish onto there. It was the only way we could make them look big, you see. I mean, you could get little... Those are small fish. But we used, I think it was a 200mm lens. This was a wonderful actor, this man.
Mr. Bond, you disappoint me. I'm not a fool, so please do not treat me as one. And that table knife, please put it back.
Harry said, would you try him? And I knew he was. I'd seen him in Zapata and one or two other things. And I said, let's grab him like that. I loved him. I used him in Valachi Papers as Maranzano. He was very good in that, too. He's a very nice man and a very fine actor. Now, the next quick thing here, and this is why really I gave Joanna Harwood a credit on the writing instead of myself. When Harry Saltzman had the idea that we should have some of the famous paintings, the Van Goghs and things, that had been stolen from the museum in Provence, but nobody could remember that, whereas this famous Goya painting of the Duke of Wellington was missing just about this time. And I had actually got on the set was the Sunflowers, you know, it was quite a well-known painting, but not to general public at that stage. This thing was in every newspaper in the world, the theft from the Royal Academy, and people were doing all sorts of things. The New York Herald Tribune sent a man carrying an enormous great thing like this, asking a policeman the way to the museum with this thing, you see. And they ran stunts. There was a thing in Life magazine about the whole of it. And she said, wouldn't it be much better to have this? So we put it in. And Harry Saltzman said, as he goes up the steps, he must say, oh, that's where it is. Ah. And I said, no, Harry, he doesn't. I said, now, go away. And he said, no, I'm sure I'm right. I said, you go away, Harry. If you don't like it, you can. I said, to Cubby, get him off the set. He's a pain in the ass. So they got Cubby off the thing. We went back, and I said to Sean, you look at it, and you go, ah, and walk on. The audience laughed for nearly 30 seconds. The whole first part of the dialogue here was absolutely drenched.
We felt that it would be interesting to surround him in this exotic place with antique furniture and so-called priceless antique furniture and collections. I will never forget Cubby's reaction when he walked in. He said, you know, hopefully jokingly, it looks a little bit like Leo Carella's ranch house, you know. Somebody said, wouldn't it be funny if we had the stolen Goya here? Which was quite a challenge for me because we were filming that scene on, this was on a Friday, and we were filming that scene the following Monday, and where could I get all that painting reproduction. So I went to the National Gallery and they gave me a transparency of the Goya, which I then projected at home onto a canvas, and I painted the Goya over that weekend. Again, I was trying with experimenting with new ideas like translucent corrugated perspex or fiberglass screens and so on, which had not been seen before in films. The inclined surfaces somehow are influenced by our form of expressionistic style. So, and I inclined the walls to give a more claustrophobic feeling to this prison set, which it basically was. Now you get into the tunnel, which was quite a problem, because it's all right, like we're doing now, when you see him go front or... yeah. But for instance, an angle like this, when he's going round the corner, I could only use two-thirds of a section of the curve, and even then it had to be elliptical.
If you start to analyze it shot for shot, this is just a piece of tubing on the silent stage, I think, or on some corner of the studio, didn't want to know, and him crawling down it, as you can imagine. It's the biggest piece of, cinema deception, I think you could call it, because look at it, it's just a round tunnel, and it goes on for a few yards down there. Cameraman's put a big light at the back.
I only had one little bit of set. We used it from all different angles, from above. It's the same one from above, from the side and everything. That's all we had, with these two little bits. In fact, even that's a perspective. You can't go down it. It was very well lit, I think, by the cameraman. He did a marvelous job here. That's the same bit on the side, now put perpendicularly.
Now comes the water, and this is a bit of a special effects.
I nearly killed myself showing Sean how to do this. We had to get a stuntman to do it eventually. It was a very stupid thing. There were all these rims around there. I showed him it was perfectly safe, and the stuntman proved with a sack of exactly my weight that you could kill yourself.
It, where did the water come from? Where does the water go to? You can't analyze it. It just has to be taken at its excitement value for the moment. And that is, again, why the sound has to work. Because if you make the sound work, you make the whole thing more believable. We tried to put some sort of sense in it, like it comes around a corner and therefore it's not so hot, and give it some progression, make up some storyline with it as we go along. There's not very much you can say about this. It's got to stand on its own. Guy escaping, and will he or will he not be caught?
This tunnel sequence influenced the entire shape of the soundtrack for the final quarter of the film, as Peter Hunt explains.
The actual sound of the entire premises came out of the fact that I knew that we were going to have this long scene with him crawling down and various things happening to him, which we got in the film. I was setting the background noise for this air conditioning when I felt maybe we should introduce something similar early on and then rather gravitate towards it, rather gradually change it until he's actually climbing into the tunnel, when we could then use it for dramatic effect or whatever else we wanted to do. We have a great deal of attention given to sound, I have to say that, in every possible sphere, by the track layers and the mixers. As I say, we had a fabulous mixer Mac, who was very temperamental in many ways, but really only because he was frustrated. Whenever he couldn't get what he wanted, he used to get very upset.
Now we're at the payoff, where James Bond pays back Dr. No for the lives of his victims and saves the American space program. And the public gets the first of its grand finales in a Bond film.
Well, the roadblock is about 3,000
I think, in
away.
Fact, that's to show you the launching of the thing from NASA. That's a piece of the launch material. I think you'll find I found a piece of film and we use that to make it look like Dr. No is interfering with the space mission. You see, it just gives it that added bit. Ordinary piece of back projection to assimilate a television screen. Yes, this is the thing they said put us over budget.
The movie is actually a significant improvement on the book in terms of this ending. In the book, the underground complex that Dr. No inhabits was hidden beneath a guano factory that served as the front for the doctor's operations, and when Bond escapes the tunnel, he takes over one of the conveyor belts and buries the good doctor under a 20-foot mound of bird droppings. This control room and the nuclear reactor and the final battle that follow are far more entertaining.
Converters, convector standing by, ignition heaters on.
The nuclear reactor, the water reactor. Well, I knew very little about reactors, I must say, and I had two technical advisors who were from a nuclear establishment in England called Harwell, and they helped me a great deal on the actual design of the reactor. The room was a complete invention as such, but again trying to incorporate some of the items that, you know, like the monitors and the artificial arms with which they handled radioactive material and so on. But the actual reactor, which is in the distance there, was based very much on the type of reactor they had at that time. Well, you see, you have to immediately tell an audience where the danger is and what can happen. And I think so you go a little bit bigger again than life. You've got a thing which changed danger level and with red lights and so on, so the audience immediately knows at what stage one is. I think I was going through that type of period at the time, you know, of breaking up the design with, you know, the main room with some interesting structural elements. I'm more interested in the overall effect of an ambiance of a set rather than in, you know, each detail of dials and switches and so on. I changed that at the next film, which was not a Bond film, combined that in Dr. Strangelove, where you had the enormous war room, which was again very simple. And the interior of the B-52 cockpit, where every switch and dial was more or less accurate. And also because Stanley Kubrick loved playing around with switches and dials. So it depends where the dramatic importance lies. Here I felt, apart from this particular console unit there, it was more the general effect of the set, the water reactor and the core of the reactor starting to glow, rather than individual switches or details. Well, the danger level sign was very important to show the audience, you know, at what state we are. And so I designed it bigger than it would have been in actual fact, and quite simple in graphic terms, but still very graphic.
This ending is still incredibly exciting today, although Terrence Young does admit that the final fate of Dr. No had its source in another picture.
I stole this from some other picture, I can't remember what. The hand, the despairing hand sliding down, disappearing. I can't remember what picture. It was a German film, like Metropolis or one of those things many years ago. I was a film critic at Cambridge, so I must have seen enough films. That took the whole of the largest stage at Pinewood, and I mean, that set today would cost you $1 million, maybe $1.5 million to build. I don't know how it was done, and it was almost entirely constructed. I believe the piece on the left was matted in, everything else was built there. I don't know how the hell he did it. And ever since this picture, everybody's been offering me things like Star Wars and every picture that's ever got science fiction in it. And I'm totally disinterested. I knew nothing about any of this. And I hope to God I never have anything to do with a reactor or a science fiction thing again in my life. I've got no interest whatsoever in it. But I keep getting these things. They say, you'd be so good with it.
Still the matter of Honey Rider, who Bond has to find.
Where's a girl like him in?
Her situation changed somewhat during production. She was originally supposed to be threatened by these land crabs that were to be devouring her, but they ran into problems, which Peter Hunt explains.
Oh, yes, I'd forgotten about it. That's right, these damn crabs. Oh, my goodness me. They practically all died, I think. Oh, yeah, we didn't do it. In the book, the crabs were eating her. That was what she was laying out there. The whole load of crabs crawling up and supposed to be going to eat her. But we did try and make the crabs didn't want to know, and they all eventually were dying, and it became a disasterville, but it didn't matter, so we didn't use them. There were shots of them, but I couldn't make it work. They looked so awful, I'm afraid, because they weren't really doing anything at a time when everything was going on. There she was in a passive state, as it were, that just held up everything. If the crabs had been crawling, or I could have made them like the rats in From Russia with Love, it would have worked. But it didn't matter. Look, it was very quick. She was, perils appalling, tied down there, and he comes and grabs her and rescues her.
Oh, and here it comes, the first of the big Bond explosions, courtesy of John Steers and his special effects team. That's a model going up, but it's extremely convincing from this angle. A few final words from Peter Hunt and Terrence Young.
And here comes our tag, which eventually, of course, was on all the James Bonds. They always started with an exciting sequence which got your audience, and they ended with a tag which we hope made the audience laugh, smile, go out feeling good.
We didn't have an ending either. We cooked this one up on the set as well. This became then a key thing in all the Bond films. We always tried to end it in a way like this, you know. And especially the very last shot of the picture.
James Bond will be back in the Criterion Collection in From Russia with Love and Goldfinger. I'd like to take this time to thank Criterion, the interviewers, the participants, and most of all, the makers of the original pictures.
It was as far as we were allowed to show. And this is the payoff, the hand letting out the rope, dropping into the water.
cut. Finish. I have nothing more to say.